Some stations on shortwave sound like they've been around since the dinosaur era, presenting stories the way they did in the 160s, 70s, and 80,000 years ago. Snap out of your Mesozoic mood and switch to Radio Netherlands, contemporary continental radio from the heart of Northwest Europe.
Hello, this is Jonathan Marks for PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another program from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
Media Network, the weekly communications program for shortwave listeners, produced and presented by Jonathan Marks.
Hello, and hold on to your headphones as our first port of call this week is the Caribbean. But which island in particular? Well, here's the early morning sign-on of one of the stations there. The third announcement gives the game away.
Oyente Lang, buen día. Radio Calbom, voy emisora de preferencia, e promé emisora comercial de Aruba, ta comisar con su transmisión de AWE, deseando todo su fiel escuchador lang un buen recepción y hopi satisfacción con nos programa lang, cual lang ta termina AWE noche pa 10 horas. Goedemorgen luisteraars, hier Radio Calbom, het eerste en meest beluisterde radiostation van Aruba. We zenden uit op een frequentie van 1440 kiloperioden per seconde, wat gelijk is aan 209 meter. We hopen dat u tot vanavond 10 uur zult genieten van al onze programma's. Listeners, your dial is at a moment set of 1,440 kilocycles in the 209-meter band. Radio Calbom, the first radio station on Aruba, invites you to stay tuned until 10 o'clock tonight and wish you all a very clear and happy reception.
Yes, we're looking at the island of Aruba this week. Part of the so-called ABC Islands, consisting of Aruba, Bonaire and Curaçao, only a few score miles north of the coast of Venezuela. But although nature has grouped what's sometimes called the Leeward Islands together, the status and future course of Aruba changed at the start of 1986. Until January the 1st, Aruba was part of the Netherlands Antilles, a group of six islands as it was then, three lying at the upper end of the Lesser Antilles chain and called St. Martin, St. Eustatius and Saba. The other three, as I mentioned, lying off the Venezuelan coast. The language spoken on the ABC Islands is called Papiamento. It's a very musical mixture of words with roots in Portuguese, Spanish, English and Dutch, plus a few Indian and African words as well.
También palabras de felicitación relacionadas con status aparte, los ser dirigidos a la gente y pueblo arubano. El programa lo pasa pues.
Perhaps you picked out the phrase status aparte there, meaning separate status, in that extract from one of the Aruban radio stations, Radio Kelpone. To find out exactly what that means, I spoke with Victor Hufkamp, who's head of Radio Netherlands Caribbean section, and asked him if we should call Aruba a separate country now.
It's a separate country within the Dutch realm. It has the same rights as, for instance, the Antilles of the Five. So until the 1st of January, it was a part of the Antilles of the Six. So now you have in the Dutch realm the Kingdom of the Netherlands, the Netherlands Antilles, five islands, and Aruba.
Okay, and what will happen next? Because this particular situation won't last forever.
Now, 2 years ago, there was a roundtable conference, and during that roundtable conference, it was decided that Aruba would get its separate status on the 1st of January 1986, and that 10 years later, the total independence would start.
What's the difference between Aruba as it was as part of the Netherlands Antilles and Aruba as it is as a separate status within the Dutch realm?
Well, so far Aruba was dependent from the central government on the main island Curaçao, and has always been very competitive versus Curaçao. Aruba has always felt itself ruled and overruled by Curaçao. So that situation is over now. Aruba has its own parliament, its own government, its own representative in The Hague, and its own governor general.
So it has a more direct contact with the Netherlands.
That's right.
What is the Netherlands responsible for as far as Aruba is concerned?
The Netherlands are responsible for foreign affairs and for the defense, as it is responsible for the foreign affairs and the defense of the other five islands now forming the Antilles of the Five.
Okay, and what will happen 10 years from now in 1996?
Well, the Netherlands said during the roundtable conference Aruba will get its separate status on the 1st of January 1986 under the condition that it will get full independence on the 1st of January 1996. Well, at the moment there are voices on Aruba who say, well, independence 1996 will be probably too early. But the Netherlands have always said that if the independence will not be reached on the 1st of January 1996, Aruba will get back into the unity of the other Antillean islands. But it's of course possible that in the meantime other islands of the Antilles of the Five will get a separate status. So it's a rather complicated matter at the moment.
And the people on Aruba will decide for themselves in 10 years' time?
Well, yeah, there will be a number of volksraadplegingen during which the people of Aruba is in a position to speak out about the future.
A lovely jingle from Radio Kelkboom there. I wish they made them like that here in Europe. But there are other stations on this island of 74 square miles. The voice of Aruba, indeed. Another medium-wave radio station on 1320 kilohertz that's obviously been to the United States to buy their jingles. So, how do the islanders earn a living?
You may say that until about 1.5 years ago, the oil refinery, the Lago oil refinery of Exxon, was the main source of income. It contributed to the national income about 50%. Now the Lago refinery is closed. And at the moment, you may say tourism is the main source of income. But of course, there's very much competition in the Caribbean.
Right, so that is indeed a problem regarding their future.
Yeah. At the moment, of course, Holland is still giving an impressive amount of development aid to Aruba when you compare it with other territories in the world.
And that would stop in 10 years' time?
Well, I think that will stop after the 1st of January 1996. Anyway, it will not be that amount as it is at the moment.
But how is all this change affecting broadcasting on the islands? Because up until now, television in the southern group of the Netherlands Antilles has been in the hands of the Netherlands Antilles Television. Mm-hmm. There is a transmitter on the island called Tele Aruba, another one in Curaçao called Tele Curaçao, nothing on Bonaire, I understand. But how has this new apart status changed?
Yeah, there was always a kind of cooperation between Tele Curaçao and Tele Aruba, But you may say that the new situation on Aruba doesn't influence the operation of the television and radio on Aruba very much, because Aruba had its own radio companies and its own television company, as Curaçao had and St. Martin has, for instance, and Bonaire has. So the separate status of Aruba will not influence the functioning of radio and television on the island.
The Aruba Anthem. The media situation on the island isn't simply limited to the four radio stations on Aruba, plus a television transmitter, though. Because they're living so close to the water, signals from other islands are audible on medium wave too, especially at night. Reception of some of the American satellite services feeding cable systems in the United States has grown in popularity too in the last few years, with a drop in prices for simple satellite dishes. Until earlier this year, reception of movie channels such as Home Box Office was possible on the islands too, until the United States company decided to scramble its signal. Because of copyright regulations, HBO is unable to hire out the complicated scramblers to customers outside the United States. The Atlanta-based cable news network is popular in the Caribbean too, at the moment still received without a decoder. It's not all television, though. Radio is still very important, and it's the prime place to promote the local music, like on Radio Antilliana, for instance, 1270 kHz medium wave. Can you hear the influence of Latin American rhythms mixed in with the Caribbean beat?
Día a día, más y más oyentes está cambiando para Radio Antilliana. Pegue a 8, 1270 de Morradio. La diferencia musical. Antillana Dinámica.
Arriva frequenza di 1270 kHz transmiti P8 Radio Antillana. Transmitendo direttamente fuori i suoi studi nella strada Bernastrat 138 San Nicolas, Aruba.
And Aruba is counted as a separate island by many amateur radio groups, but not yet as an independent nation. 10 years, though, isn't all that long away. Now let's switch continents.
Accent on Asia.
And I'm joined now by one of our Asia Scan presenters, Pete Myers, with a story on how radio is being given a boost over there.
Well, Jonathan, let's turn to my area, because in downtown Kuala Lumpur, a small office complex is busy tackling media problems facing more than two-thirds of the world's population. It's called the Asia-Pacific Broadcasting Union, and its current Secretary-General, Hugh Leonard, has been in the news pointing out the severe problems facing broadcasting in this vast region. Although the World Cup has only just finished in Mexico, negotiations for satellite rights for the 1990 and 1994 Cup finals are already well underway. The ABU acts as a central body when negotiating for major sporting events, but Leonard points out that costs are rapidly spiraling. The Seoul Olympics in 1988 is an excellent example. The rights started around the $500,000 figure, but very rapidly escalated to $33 million, and then the final price of $300 million, making it almost impossible for many developing countries to afford to pay their share. This problem is having its spin-offs in the area of radio too. Television is seen as a glamorous prestige symbol by many countries in the world, with the result that it siphons off a lion's share of any broadcasting budget. The escalating TV costs are forcing radio to cut back, even though radio reaches far more people in the world than television. The Asian Pacific Broadcasting Union hopes to give far more attention to radio development in the next few years. It doesn't take much to start a radio station, but further development is often difficult and costly. India, for example, managed to serve 80% of its population in a relatively short time. But reaching the remaining 20% is the current challenge, and the reason why some new high-power shortwave transmitters are being built at many existing sites to serve remote areas, plus more than 100 FM transmitters by 1990. So the ABU has set up a technical advisory unit, which is now helping developing countries in Asia and the Pacific with their radio needs. Brunei has expressed the desire to start a shortwave service, and so ABU personnel are being sent there. An expert from the People's Republic of China is currently in Micronesia to help set up a radio service to cover this vast area, while an engineer from All India Radio is now in Papua New Guinea as a consultant. It's hoped that by taking this approach, radio can get a necessary boost again.
Now let's look at some media news from Andy Sennett of the World Radio TV Handbook in Copenhagen. First, if you're looking for Radio Denmark, then most of the printed information currently available is wrong because of some major changes they made recently. At 09 hours UTC, 11770 kHz is now being used. At 12 hours, 15180 is on the air. At 14 hours, look for them on new 15120. At 15 hours, on 15125. At 20:30 UTC, 15155 kHz is on the air, and at 21 hours UTC, try 9745. Then at 22 and 23 hours UTC, 11745 kHz is the new channel. And the final change is at midnight UTC, try 11840 kHz for Radio Denmark. An elusive catch.
De lytter til Danmarks Radio.
This is Radio Denmark, Copenhagen, Denmark.
And that's the interval signal to look for. Andy also reports a discrepancy which has appeared concerning Norfolk Island in the Pacific. The single station there has been reported as off the air because the medium wave transmitter has worn out and they're waiting for a new one to arrive. However, last month's edition of the New Zealand DX Times has a logging from Brian Clark at Papamoa Beach, in which he says he heard Norfolk Island at 0428 UTC on 1566 kHz. So we wonder if there's a story behind that. Meanwhile, WRTH collaborator Bill Harms in the USA, who specialises in Korea, has noted that many people have been hearing what they believe is Pyongyang, North Korea, on 3350 and 3920 kHz. In fact, both these are North Korean regional stations which have moved frequency. One of them, on 3350, is Pyongsong, which has moved from 2765, and the one on 3920 is at a place called Sinewiju, which has moved from 2745 kHz. These are currently being widely heard in Asia and parts of North America. Pete.
After our coverage of the Electronic Communications Privacy Bill drawn up in the United States, a number of listeners in Britain have pointed out a piece of legislation which quietly became law there back in April. The Interception of Communication Act, 1985, makes it an offence for any unauthorised person to intentionally intercept a communication by post or by means of a public telecommunications system. The main aim of the Act is to safeguard unauthorised telephone tapping by private investigators, police or customs authorities. But the wording of the Act also applies to communications intercepted with a shortwave radio. Whilst nobody is forbidden to listen to international broadcasts or amateur radio traffic, tuning in telex or electronic data transmissions and decoding them is now technically an offence, punishable with a fine or up to 2 years in prison. In practice, however, telex and telex over radio decoders remain in the UK shops to serve the amateur radio market. The only point where the new legislation is likely to cause problems is in the case of the shortwave listener trying to verify utility stations such as press bureaus or coastal traffic. Sending a reception report is written evidence saying that you have been listening in to utility traffic. Whilst the majority of European and North American utility stations are quite friendly, even though they don't need reception reports, a few complain directly to the listener's national administration that their private traffic is being deliberately monitored by an unauthorized user. It will therefore be interesting to see how the British authorities interpret this new legislation. No doubt it won't deter those involved in industrial espionage. Illegal bugging is currently costing British industry some £2.5 billion a year, which is why voice scrambling units are selling so well.
Thanks, Pete. Now to the phone and this message from South Wales.
Hello, Jonathan. This is Al Dupre from Red Dragon Radio in Cardiff in Wales. An item for Media Network regarding Red Dragon DX, our shortwave feature. It's now being extended to once a week, a five-minute feature covering both shortwave, medium wave and FM due to the surprising, for me anyway, popularity of the feature. So it's being extended. What's going to happen now is it will be on, and this is the universal time, at 0015 every Saturday morning, 0015 UTC, every Saturday morning for a five-minute bulletin, depending on how much news we have in, including, of course, the Media Network Radio Netherlands information sheets, which you send me. So I hope this is of interest to you, and thank you very much indeed, and I'll continue to plug away at Media Network. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
And thank you, Al. The medium wave frequency for Red Dragon Radio, by the way, is 1359 kilohertz. 1359.
Media Network's Book Review.
And we turn to a new book entitled A Sign to Listen, brought out by two former employees of the BBC Monitoring Service. Quite often you'll hear mention of the monitoring service located at a place called Caversham near Reading, England. That's about 20 minutes on the train from London. But before that ever existed, there was a short period of 4 years during the Second World War when the entire monitoring was done at a place near Evesham. Just before war broke out, the British authorities realised that asking a few translators working at BBC Broadcasting House in London to monitor a few foreign stations wasn't going to be sufficient if conflict should break out. So a country mansion was acquired in the midst of a wooded estate on a spur of low hills above the River Avon as it winds its way towards the town of Tewkesbury. Between August 1939 and the start of 1940, various nationalities, mostly refugees from Nazi Germany, as well as English recruits from all walks of life, were sent to Wood Norton, as it was called. They were to listen to enemy broadcasts and also countries under threat of occupation. This new book traces the setting up of what later became known as the BBC Monitoring Service and uses plenty of anecdotes to put over the atmosphere.
The Scandinavians, records Brenda Clear, have now arrived in Wood Norton. The fame of one of them preceded her weeks in advance. She was said to be a ravishing blonde who wore white boots. One day, our handsome Victor Frank beheld a fair girl coming downstairs in Mrs. Smith's house in white boots. He said, "Are you finished?" She looked completely terrified and replied, "No, I'm just beginning," and made off rapidly in the direction of the typing pool. She was a new typist. At the beginning of April, the broadcasting stations of Europe were preoccupied with the proposed tightening of the blockade, and most commentators were speculating about the next steps to be taken by the Allies. The German radio devoted much time to the position of the neutrals, and a report from a Danish paper, broadcast by Deutschlandsender on April 5th, also talked of the possibility that the Western powers might land 100,000 men on the Norwegian coast in order to push southward. "The danger for Nordic states is increasing day by day," said Zeesen Radio, the station which transmitted German external service programmes on shortwave, in an English broadcast for North America on the same day.
If you mention wartime enemy broadcasts in English to someone in Britain today, those who can remember usually come up with the name of William Joyce, otherwise known as Lord Haw-Haw. According to the BBC monitors, this broadcaster had an excellent microphone manner and often enjoyed imitating Winston Churchill. He always spoke slowly and clearly to allow for mediocre reception conditions. Broadcasts from Mussolini's Italy, on the other hand, were awful in English, and monitors found talks by Ezra Pound incoherent and often impossible to summarise. The BBC also took down the names and messages from prisoners of war broadcast by the Nazi transmitters. June the 22nd, 1941 stands out in the book as a momentous day, as recounted by Gordon Rattray Taylor, who had an evening shift the night before.
My first warning was a message from Y unit that Deutschlandsender was radiating a carrier wave, followed by a message that other German transmitters were warming up. About half an hour later, it was announced that Goebbels would be coming to the microphone. Obviously, something big was afoot. So I turned on the receiver in the bureau and listened to Goebbels with one ear while coping with stuff from South America and so on. He started neutrally, but it became clear that he was working round to a critical attack on Russia, and the idea dawned that Germany was going to break off relations or even perhaps attack. After phoning London, I went to the listening room and suggested that additional German monitors should be brought in. I also phoned transport. As far as the bureau was concerned, it ended with the day shift coming in all unaware and finding the room knee-deep in teleprinter paper. I knocked off about 9:30, having had neither supper nor breakfast, and exhausted.
As the war progressed, so Wood Norton became more important and more cramped for space. A move to Caversham in Reading was imminent. At the start of 1942, monitors also began to notice changes in the Goebbels' war of words.
The adjustments were made gradually, almost imperceptibly. Goebbels' propaganda machine had performed brilliantly for 2 years, but in its original version, it had been fitted with poor brakes and no reverse gear. Now it had to be adapted to the changed character of the war, and that necessitated repeated ad hoc modifications and emergency repairs. In consequence, its performance became not uniformly poor, but rather erratic. The simplest device adopted to adjust the radio programs to the altered situation was to change the volume of output. This was the case notably with front reports, with martial music, and with political and military commentaries. The time devoted to front reports dropped from an average of 1 hour daily in September 1941 to roughly 17 minutes at the end of January 1942.
Extracts from Assigned to Listen, written by Olive Renier and Vladimir Rubinstein, but quoting in fact several dozen personal experiences between 1939 and 1943. Fascinating reading if you're interested in how and why the BBC started to monitor the radio airwaves. It also gives an insight into often routine yet vital work that those people did, and of course still do. The book is published by BBC External Services at a cover price of £3.95, and that doesn't include postage costs. Now, all we have to do is to grab tickets, passport and a change of socks to take the Radio Netherlands Roadshow to Montreal, Canada. Join us next week to find out the results. Hope we don't miss the plane. And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website, where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.